All right, everybody, I think we're going to get started with the afternoon. We have Chris Hecker, Paul Sopasante, and a
Sopasante, that was nice.
I took a couple years of Italian just for this moment. I like to pronounce Paul's name. They're going to have a dialogue on depth that will be involving all of you, hopefully, quite soon. So take it away, Chris and Paul.
Okay, so I'm Chris, and thanks for coming. I was actually glad we were scheduled against another thing, because I want to make sure that the people here are kind of interested in having a serious conversation, not that it was like the thing you had to go to because you paid money for your pass or whatever. So hopefully everyone who's here really wants to talk about this stuff. And this is Paul, who I've been mispronouncing his last name according to John for the past 5 years that I've known him. Sotasante, not Sotasante. And it really is going to be a discussion. Now, under normal circumstances, I tend to give lectures and not do panels. I'm not the biggest fan of panels. Like at the GDC, we tend to ding them for various reasons. But the reason this is going to be a panel comes down to this question. You have to ask yourself, if you're going to talk about depth, what is depth? And the problem is I don't actually know. Which makes me quite unqualified to give a talk about it. So that's where all of you guys and Paul come in. I'm hoping that we can start to feel out the boundaries of the question of what is depth. And I don't think actually what is depth is really the most operative question. It's just might be the first question you ask. But start to feel out the space of what makes something deep versus not deep. What are the characteristics of that kind of thing? And I want to point out really clearly that we're not, both Paul and I are talking about a specific kind of depth. The word deep is in some sense used like fun sometimes in games, and we're not, we're going to try and carve it down to something more specific. And in doing so, we're not saying depth is something that is makes your game good, and if you don't have it, your game is bad at all. And we'll give a bunch of examples of that kind of things, and I'm sure you guys can come up with more. I care a lot about depth because I'm making this game Spy Party, this is my like kind of mission statement for Spy Party, is I want it to be a deep player skill competitive multiplayer game about human behavior. And so each word in here is kind of carefully chosen, player skill as opposed to avatar skill. It's competitive, it's multiplayer online. I want it to be deep about human behavior. It means subtlety and psychology and these kinds of things. But it still remains to be seen what is deep. I've been following, like, I worked on Spore before I worked on, before I started working at Spy Party, and I worked on Spore for 6 years, and I think there's a lot of things you could say good and bad about Spore, but one thing you could say is that Spore was definitely not deep, the game that we ended up shipping, at least most of the gameplay parts. I think the creature editor, for example, was relatively deep. And one of the things I think we did wrong that I'm trying to correct in Spy Party is following Blizzard's design methodology, which is called depth first, accessibility later. Basically, we worried about making Spore accessible and never got to the depth. And so if you want a deep game, you kind of have to work on that first. What is the thing that someone wants to play for 500 hours? And then you can make it accessible later with tutorials and that sort of thing. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. And so I wanted to give one example from Spy Party really quickly about how I think about depth and how I strive to make the game deeper. So I'll talk to you about a moment in the game that happens and what I saw as the problem with that moment and then how I tried to fix it. In Spy Party, one of the players plays the spy and they're carrying out missions like bugging the ambassador or poisoning the drink or those kinds of things. And because I want it to be this player skill competitive game, I wanted elite players to always be able to win against merely good players. The problem was when the spy was going to pull off a mission and he or she knew that the sniper was looking right at him, you couldn't actually do anything because the tells for each mission were of a certain level of obviousness. They were balanced to be not obvious if you weren't looking at them, but if they were looking at them, you could find them. And this meant that even an elite spy had to just back away from a mission if they knew that a merely good sniper was watching them. And I thought that was a problem in the design because I wanted this player skill hierarchy of like the person will just, if the person is better than you, they will basically always win. And that comes from inspirational games that are inspirational to me, like Counter-Strike or Go or games like that are just intensely player skill oriented. And so what I decided to do is I looked at Gears of War's action active reload thing, which is when you have to reload, you can press a button and do a little tiny little player skill kind of reflex oriented test for what, whether you jam the gun or do a normal reload or get extra an extra fast reload. And I talked to Cliff about it and about how they it's always the same sliders for the active reload. So it just becomes a rote memorization. The player never has to pay attention to it. It just becomes a beat batching thing after a while. And I didn't want that. And I said, did they try and randomize it? So we talked about it a little bit. And I came up with this thing where it's basically a clone of that, except for it randomizes in two ways. But it makes a little player skill test, an action test, I call it, when you want to perform the a spy mission. And if you hit the red, that means a failure, and your tell is way more obvious than the normal. If you ignore it completely or hit the white area, then you have a normal tell, like in the previous, like before I added this feature. And if you hit the green, you've perfected the action test, and your tell is very subtle. And so I gave a talk at NYU where we talked about this as part of the talk, and I posted on this, and Paul, in addition to being a great game designer, also happens to be one of the two elite Spy Party playtesters. So Paul and our friend Ian are kind of the two guys that I'm making the game for right now, right? And they both played about 12 hours of the game, not all in one sitting. But and so Paul, actually, being an opinionated game designer, of course, wrote a blog post about why I thought this wasn't going to work. And so we kind of like hammered, you know, back and forth, and I finally implemented it. And there were a bunch of like, and I wasn't sure whether it was going to work either, because it's like, it you know, it's kind of like a weird thing, like adding this little physical skill thing in there. And I implemented it, and then I had Paul and Ian over to playtest, and it turns out it did work pretty well, but it worked in a different way than we thought it might, than the positive. It did create a little bit of a player skill physical, like, risk cliff, right? As the spy, you've got to decide whether you're going to go for it or not, right? So if you know the person's looking at you, you can actually make a conscious choice, an interesting choice to hearken, to foreshadow some conversations we're going to have later. An interesting choice about whether to actually try and do the action test or whether to back away and walk away. But another thing happened, which was totally emergent, which is that Ian is the spy, is the sniper playtester, and Paul plays the spy almost exclusively at this point at the elite levels. It made Ian start playing a more behavioral game, because now he couldn't be sure of seeing tells. He didn't know. He had to assume, for the sake of being highly competitive, that Paul was going to nail the action test every time, which Paul wouldn't do, but just for the sake of being careful. And he had to assume that he wasn't going to see the harder tells and start looking for more suspicious behavior. And so that added like another component of depth on the sniper side that I wasn't even counting on. I was expecting some spy side depth. But so that's an example of a place where I was like, this moment in the game I don't feel like has enough depth. It feels like it's got a kind of a predictable outcome in some sense, where if the spy with the old game tried to perform the mission, it would just get them shot. Or they can back away, which means they can't make progress. And this adds this level of complexity in this small little thing that adds this complexity that tries to make the game deeper. Okay, so here are some discussion topics to show you how we think about this stuff. This is both from talking to Paul and other designers and stuff about these topics, just in general and in preparing for this talk, and just thinking about it myself as I've been trying to make this game. I think it's important to contrast, to tease apart deep the, like, you know, oh, this game's really deep, in the same way you say this game's really fun, from, if you're going to try and use deep as a kind of characteristic of a game design or a gameplay experience, from these words on the other side, like hard. So Super Meat Boy, I was talking to Edmund about this, and like he agreed. Super Meat Boy is more hard than it is deep, right? It's a great game. I love Super Meat Boy. But if you had to, like, and again, this is going without defining deep or hard in some sense. I mean, Super Meat Boy has a reflex-oriented physical skill challenge. It's basically the core of the game, right? But it doesn't feel like there's a lot of depth there. There's some depth in making choices about the thing, but it's much more of a physical skill challenge. And it's a great game. So it's not, this is, again, very important to point out. This is more like saying this painting has more blue in it than it is like saying this is a better painting. That's not what I'm saying. And I think hard can have mental and physical components. Like there's the complexity of memorizing something, and things are the difficulty of memorizing things, you know, limits of your brain are just as important as limits of your physical body. Complicated is also different from deep. These all things are all related. I don't think these are orthogonal in the sense that you can move in one axis without affecting the other axis at all. But I think it gets I think that's the interactions are subtle. Meaningful, when I say meaningful, I'm talking about the kind of like, whoa, man, that's deep, kind of thematic profundity. So you might say, like, the story in Braid is trying to be meaningful and deep in a way that I want to separate out from this usage of the term deep, this kind of more mechanical usage. Emergent, a game like, I mean, there's Conway's Game of Life, which is not really a game, but, you know, where a lot of emergent complexity comes out, or you look at the old school Looking Glass games like Thief and System Shock, where there's a lot of emergent stuff that's happening, and people call that a kind of depth, but it's slightly different from what I'm talking about as well. Like, no one would call, I think, Conway's Game of Life is not really a deep interaction, but there's like this chaotic, like butterfly flaps and wings in China kind of thing that's going on, which is clearly amazing and beautiful, but it's not depth. And the last one, which Paul will talk about a little bit more, is wide, or, you know, deep versus wide, or depth versus breadth. A lot of stuff in the game. A game like The Sims, for example, is a very wide game. It has a lot of breadth, but not necessarily a lot of depth. And Paul has some more examples of that. Then there's the single player versus multiplayer. Originally, if you look online, there's Richard Garfield's written a bunch of really cool articles and given some talks about game design, obviously. And one of the things he did recently, and some articles from a couple years ago about luck and skill, and saying it's not a versus thing. But anyway, he defines ortho games as the kind of games he's interested in studying, which are games like Magic the Gathering or basketball or Counter-Strike, like multiplayer, player skill-based games. And it's interesting because I think that depth is cuts across that. Like, originally when we first started talking about it, do you have to be multiplayer to be deep? And I don't think that's true. A game like a roguelike, like Shiren the Wanderer, I think is a very deep game. I think Braid's puzzles, ignoring the thematic depth, having Braid's puzzles have a deepness of the mechanical type that I'm talking about. So I don't think it's actually a single or multiplayer game. There are multiplayer games that are not deep as well. And then player versus avatar skill. You might think, or I might have thought, that player skill was the only path to depth, and I don't think that's true. Again, Shirin is not player skill in the normal sense of the term. You're collecting items and gaining hit points and things like that that are hallmarks of avatar skill games, yet it can still be quite deep. I've got some games here at the bottom that I think are interesting to think about when talking and teasing apart these issues. Dwarf Fortress is another example of an avatar skill-based, quite deep single-player game. Things like Little Big Planet in The Sims to some extent, or The Creature Editor in Spore, have this like user-generated content thing that I would file under the emergent kind of more than the deep thing. So that's kind of like, I'm going to leave this slide up for people to think about and stuff, and then introduce Paul, who Paul's an old friend of mine. Like I said, he's an excellent Spy Party player, and worked at Wizards of the Coast, and then on Darkspore, and since has gone indie. And we've been talking about this stuff for a long time. So,
yeah. So I sort of have a background in strategy games. Again, I worked at Wizards of the Coast for 5 years. I worked on Magic a lot, and those aren't the only games that I play, but I play a lot of them, and a lot of the games I design are sort of in the strategy space. So when I was thinking about, you know, Chris brought up this idea of depth, and it's something that you can sort of look at a game and sort of know inherently, like, is this game deep or is it not? But when I actually sat down and thought about, like, what does that mean and what is it, I realized that I didn't really know either. So, you know, we're both in the same boat here, and that's why we wanted to involve you. But one thing that I kept coming back to was this idea of a quote from Sid Meier, which is that a game is a series of interesting choices. And I don't think that definition encompasses games in all respects by any means, but I named my blog after, you know, the place where I bashed Chris's design sense and it was wrong. But it's a good place to think about depth. And I think there's a lot, you know, strategy games are often associated with depth. And I think that it's true that games, when I look at a game, if it has a lot of interesting choices in it, then generally I would consider that to be a deep game. So that's sort of where I started thinking about depth. And sort of expand it up from there. There are a couple places that you can sort of screw up. Like, it's easy to add choices to your game, right? But there's two ways that things can sort of go wrong. Like, you can make choices where one is obviously better than the other, and it's no longer interesting. Fair enough. You can also make choices where the players can't understand the difference between the choices or sort of the ramifications of choosing one or the other. And then I think you also lose out on depth there. And coming from, I also have sort of a board game background in designing them and playing them a lot. Board games sort of have a leg up there where, just inherently by being a board game, players have to understand the mechanics and the rules of the game because that's the only way they play it. They have to be the arbiter of what happens in the game. And so I think in board games they can sort of get away with, you know, having those choices necessarily the players understand, whereas computer games it's easy to get into a trap of, like, the computer's going to handle this, so we can just sort of throw any choice at the player and they can handle it. But at the same time, it's not really deep if they don't understand what they're doing. And maybe like character creation in an RPG at the beginning of the game is a good example of that, where it's this really interesting deep choice, but when it's thrown at you, you have no idea what any of these choices mean in the game. And so at that point, are you really adding depth? You know, maybe you're adding some replayability, and maybe the second time through the game, you've got some depth. And I'm not saying that just because you're not necessarily adding, getting depth out of it, that you shouldn't have character creation in RPG, but you're maybe not getting as much out of it as you might. And I also wanted to talk about breadth. You know, again, going back to Magic, Magic is a game with a lot of breadth. It has 10,000, 15,000 cards that have been made throughout the years. And it also has a lot of complexity, but at the same time, that complexity is sort of local complexity and rather than global. And what I mean by that is that when you're playing Magic, you only need to understand the cards that are present right now that you and your friends have brought to the table. So you don't necessarily have to understand all 15,000 cards to play the game. So I would actually put Magic sort of in the middle on complexity, but high on breadth, and then clearly high on depth. You know, most people, I think, would agree that Magic is one of the more deep games, perhaps even in existence. And then you've got a game like World of Warcraft, which is, you know, again, lots of breadth, but I would argue not a lot of depth. You know, there's not a ton of interesting choices in WoW, because, you know, the game's, the goal there is to be very accessible, to give people a lot of different things to do, but not to make a lot of strategic choices. Then there's games like NetHacker. You know, I've been playing Binding of Isaac, and also from Edmund, and I think that game actually has quite a bit of depth. You know, it comes from each time you play, you're getting these different sort of random power-ups to your character, and the way that those influence the way that you play and the randomness of the enemies actually creates a lot of interesting choices in terms of how you encounter the rooms, in which do you trade your health for power-ups and things like that. So I think breadth is, again, like Chris said, you know, it's not related to depth. You can have breadth without having depth, but it is a tool to give you depth if you use it in the right way. Chris mentioned single player versus multiplayer. I think that, you know, it's like you said, it's easy to have depth in single player games. So there's a game, you know, Civilization, the game that has a lot of complexity but also a lot of depth. In multiplayer, I think it's actually easier to, and I'm sort of most interested in games that are simple and deep. Like, again, if you throw in a lot of complexity, you can get depth out of that. But is that as interesting as a game that's very simple but also still has that depth? And I think that actually Desktop Dungeons is a good example of a game where they took, you know, a traditionally very complicated genre and distilled it down to a 5-10 minute experience with only its core parts, and yet still retained a lot of that depth. And they got a lot of it out of the combinatorics of sort of the possibility space. You know, at the beginning of the game, you choose your race, which is a really important choice. You choose your class, another important choice. And then you have to choose your god as you're playing, and that's out of a subset of things. And then which monsters show up is, you know, again, out of a subset, but changes how you play and how the dungeon is laid out and which items you have access to, et cetera. Each time you play, it's a completely different experience, and you're making interesting choices again based on sort of what the game threw at you and also what you chose in the beginning. StarCraft, an example of a multiplayer game that is both simple and deep. And I think that if you've heard Dustin Browder talk about sort of how they designed StarCraft and StarCraft II, it's all about, you know, they're all about making sure that there's only one unit for each job, right? Like, they never have any overlap between two different units. Each one has a reason for existing and a reason why you would build it. And contrast that with a game like Total Annihilation, where there's hundreds of units, and that was sort of lauded as a good thing, at least on the back of the box, but at the same time, like, now it's back to that point I was making about overwhelming the player with choices. Like, they can't understand anymore why I would build this unit over that unit, or why my opponent would do that. And I think Total Annihilation, while it had some really cool aspects, ended up being a lot less deep than StarCraft is. But yeah, getting back to you know, Desktop Dungeons, a game that I found really inspiring, I'm actually working on sort of taking that same formula just as an experiment and applying it to Civilization, to like the empire building genre. And so what does it mean when you take empire building and distill that down to its sort of core elements? And it's an interesting exercise. Like, I recommend trying to do it. And basically, you start looking at everything in the game, and you're thinking, like, you know, which of these elements don't pay off in terms of their complexity versus the amount of depth I'm getting in them. And also in terms of turn length. You know, what's adding a lot of turn length but giving me very little depth? So some things I've taken out are unit movement. You know, you no longer move your units around the map. You just build them, and they're sort of defensive stationary things. And the game is now about barbarians coming at you instead of you going out and trying to expand. You can only build one thing a turn. Again, that cuts down on turn length a lot. It cuts down on complexity. And it's actually almost added depth in some ways because now there's trade-offs. You have to plan ahead. You know, if you know that you're going to need 3 units in the city in 3 turns, you better start building them now, et cetera. And maybe that's a trade-off versus building something somewhere else in your empire. And then I've removed a bunch of other things, like other players, culture, religion, diplomacy, water, spy. So everything that I thought, you know, makes sense in Civilization, but doesn't make sense in this sort of more core 10-minute experience, I took out. And it's been enlightening and sort of a fun experiment. And, you know, eventually I want to put that up for free and see what people think. But
do you want to talk about the 500-hour thing? Because it's kind of where we... So the way this is going to work is, if you have... We will just babble up here forever because we continue to talk about this and they're trying to tease it all apart. But if you have things to say as well, raise your hand. And if we're ignoring you, cough or something, and we'll start to work you in. If no one has anything to say, then we'll just talk the entire time. But okay, so I'm going to ask Paul a question. I have two questions. We'll start a discussion here, and then you guys remember your, so there's three of you out there. So two things I want to talk about.
Yeah.
One, there's the 500-hour. Do you have to be deep to get a 500-hour game? So like League of Legends is your example there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a quick one, but I was just thinking about, like, you know, the... We talked a lot at Maxis and just in general with my friends about like making 500-hour games, just making games that people that are super replayable, that people want to play over and over again. Multiplayer is like a great way to do that. You know, obviously games like Counter-Strike, people play them over and over and over again.
But people don't play all shooters over and over again. So something about Counter-Strike, which I would claim is the depth thing, which is the thing that makes it still to this day at the top of the...
Yep. So the question is like, can you make a game that people will play that long without it being deep? And my gut answer was no. You know, like League of Legends, another good example of a game people play 500,000 more hours on. Definitely a deep game. Tons of choices you make outside of the game, inside the game, interesting choices, a lot going on there. The only counterexample I could think of is a game called I Want to Be the Guy, or that genre of games. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's an example of, super punishing, super hard game where it's just so far on the hard metric that people will bang their head against it for that many hours just trying to prove that they can be the guy, right? And you have to be a certain type of person to put yourself through that. But in general, I think it is true that games have to be deep to sort of support that sort of crazy replayability that sort of everybody wants to see in their game.
What about Solitaire?
Okay. Go. Sorry. Bejeweled, Solitaire, and sports.
Yeah.
Sports. Most sports are very deep. Like I think basketball is a fantastically deep game. So.
Right. And football too. I mean.
Yeah.
There's a lot that comes down to like the choices of the plays and whatnot, and sort of there's also the Yomi in football, and that's something I didn't talk about in the multiplayer section, which I'll tangent about a bit. One of the ways you can get depth in multiplayer is this concept of Yomi, where you know not only do you have an opponent, a human opponent who's unpredictable, but you also have this sort of trying to outthink your opponent. And I'm sort of not, as a designer, interested in the sort of boring Yomi of rock, paper, scissors, where it's just like, okay, I know he did rock last time, so maybe I want to do paper this time. But what I'm interested in is when you do that, but you also have a lot of other things sort of coming into it, sort of influencing it. And Spy Party is a great example, where when I play with Ian as a spy, I'm responsible for choosing which missions I'm going to do. And I can choose from a subset. And we usually do 3 out of 4. So there are times when I play with him, you know, 5-10 games in a row, where I'll just sit there after a game and just agonize for, you know, a minute or 2 minutes just thinking about, like, what mission should I do? Like, what is he going to think that I'm going to do? And what, you know, he's been watching the statues a lot, but I got caught at the bookcase last time, and so maybe I should do bookcase again because he won't be watching for it, but I did that last time, and so he's totally going to see that coming. And you know, maybe I'll go check my watch at the beginning because I haven't done that in 10 games. And, you know, I'm just like this game plan thing. I could spend forever on that. And that Yomi is really interesting to me, where there's all these different things that sort of make it different each time, where it's not just rock, paper, scissors, and they're all the same every time.
So I think sports are totally deep. So I think we answered the sports 500 question. But then, we had Solitaire and Bejeweled. Bejeweled's kind of an interesting example of like,
right.
I mean, I don't know, like Drop 7 versus Bejeweled. Drop 7's very deep, is much more much deeper, but people don't play it for as many billions of hours. So like, I don't know, Bejeweled is kind of like, to me, I guess that would be a good example of a game that I don't think is that deep that you do play for because it's more of just a pastime.
Right,
it's like,
maybe there's an example
I'm crocheting.
Of like the relaxing
game.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I don't. It's that Super Meat Boy also has depth, right? It's not, but compared like Drop 7 versus Bejeweled, if you're just judging depth, which doesn't mean one's better than the other at all, but Drop 7 is a deeper game, right? Like there is more of a strategy.
I think though that like your metric on this is right. You just might be too small of a number of hours. I feel like what you want is like 5,000.
Because 500 hours is just not enough.
Like, when you play Drop 7, when you stop playing Drop 7, you still think about Drop 7.
Right.
And that's the difference between like a pastime and like a depth session.
Right, so you're like playing Drop 7 like you're playing Go, whereas you're playing Bejeweled like you're crocheting or whatever.
Is Bejeweled more addictive than it is? It's got a lot of addictive elements, and that's what keeps you going.
That's true. I mean, addictive could be on this list. I mean, I think addictive is more a high-level thing. Like, some of these things make something addictive, but it's a true thing that doesn't necessarily... Like, there's... Yeah, you play... You click cows in a different way than you shoot dudes in Counter-Strike, right? Like, it's different...
I'm just expressing that I'm really surprised. That, like, playing Bejeweled during this really stressful period.
Yeah.
Like, I was sitting in a hospital room with my dad who had, like, cancer, and, like, I'm playing Bejeweled, and, like...
Because you played Bejeweled.
I got to the point where I was scoring like multiple millions.
Right.
People like challenged me with Bejeweled. There's actually like some weird point at which I see the Bejeweled board differently, and I actually I don't even know how it happens, but I'm getting like 5 chains all the time, and I'm like, how did that happen?
Right.
And I thought this game had no skill at all. It's way different.
I think there is skill in Bejeweled. Clearly, you can plan ahead and line things up, but the base level like. You go in to play Bejeweled, you're not playing necessarily.
Angry Birds.
Angry Birds? That may be at the that may be the crocheting level of, and I don't mean that as a criticism either. It's a pastime is a better thing. I think crocheting is kind of cool actually. But then solitaire was the other thing, and that kind of seems to me at least. And again, this is I'm clueless, like so we don't know, but like those seem like pastime style things. But that's a good example of like to answer your question that you asked earlier, which we just turned into a little discussion, which is are there games that are 500 hours that are not deep? And I think pastimes is a perfect example. So Farmville, I don't know if you play, I don't know if so many people play 500 hours of it, but certainly
probably
hundreds of hours. I want to not bop between topics as much as I would like to quote unquote go deep on topics. So do you have something still on this topic that you were? Who has something still on this pastime versus? Okay, so yeah, topic change. Cue them up.
One thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of deep games and being 500 hours, I guess you just said that you didn't think it was very deep World of Warcraft, but when you say 500 hours plus, it's the first game that reminds me, like,
yeah, true.
Is that uncompelling again? Is that a kind of addictive thing? Or what?
Yeah, as someone who's played 500 hours, why did you play?
I think it comes out of a couple things. One is social aspects, and two is addictive. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a harsh way to put it, but I mean, the game's definitely shown to be, it's got that quality that makes you keep coming back and I don't think it's because of strategic depth for the most part, you know, especially with the internet being what it is and every boss strategy being up on the internet within an hour before it even launches during beta.
Right? On part of the designers being compelling to the hours,
yeah, I think there's some fear on the part of designers that depth is not accessible or that it's difficult to have votes. And there's some amount of truth to that. Like, depth can scare away, you know, potentially some portion of your audience.
This was to keep coming back to that Richard Garfield luck and skill thing. It's a really fascinating set of talks and stuff like that up there. But he makes in addition to making the luck versus skill as a false dichotomy thing, and he gives a bunch of example games, and including real and fake games that have both or neither. He actually talks. There's a section in the talk where he talks about luck as a useful tool for kind of, in some sense, adding replayability. It wouldn't necessarily be adding depth, but things like it allows the player to blame the system instead of themselves. Like a totally harsh player skill game where there's no card draw or no dice roll or anything. Like it's just your fault when you lose, and that's. I mean, if I play Go and I lose, like I'm dumb. Like I can't blame anybody else. Whereas I play poker and I lose, I'm unlucky. And that's a really interesting, and both I think Hold'em and Go. There's a great talk by Frank Lance. It's on the GDC Vault from last year. It was a beautiful game design talk about poker and Go. And they're both, I think, equally beautiful, brilliant, deep games, but in very different ways. And I think that luck thing is part of that. So
it comes out of randomness, really. Like randomness is like a huge tool for, especially for single player games, because I do think it is a little bit harder to build depth into single player games than multiplayer games because of what we talked about. But if you just sort of set up a structure and then throw randomness inside it, and I talked about Desktop Dungeons and sort of how they get at that, and games like Spelunky. Or even Civilization, you know, is most people play that with a random map in a random, or maybe not a random empire, but a random map every time.
I mean, Shirin is very randomized. I mean,
right.
Roguelikes.
Right, and that gets you the replayability, and it gets you, like, it's a lot easier to sort of generate the strategic depth when you just create, like, a really good structure and then throw random elements into it and have the player encounter them inside that.
The depth comes out of, like, some fractal nature of the game that you're exploring, so there's always something to learn. That's why you play 100 hours. It's not like I can just play this forever.
Right, although I do want to differentiate it from emergent, like on this slide, though, because I think there are emergent games, like games that have a lot of emergent properties that don't qualify as deep in the way that we're kind of talking about that, like, I guess strategic depth, in some sense, is overly constraining, because there, I mean, Counter-Strike is strategically deep, but it's also physically deep. Like, it's a sport, you know what I mean? Like, that's why basketball is a good example, but...
like, World of Warcraft is socially, it's very deep, right? Like, you don't know what's going to happen the next time you play the game with people. It's like, whereas it's not deep in terms of, like, solving quests. That's not...
Right.
I would argue as well that the depth in World of Warcraft comes from progression, not from the raid-like interaction, but from the choice that you make as your character progresses, which is the skills that you hear.
You're the wild guy.
There is quite a bit of depth in building your character. What you do
is that. Well, is it depth or is it breadth and complexity, which aren't bad things. I'm not saying they're bad, but it's not clear they're depth. Like, are the choices?
I would argue that we're just playing with that too. Sometimes
they're clearly capable of making a very deep game. StarCraft is an awesomely deep game, so they may have chosen not to do that.
I think the idea is that they wanted the game to have depth, and they built it from the beginning to have depth in their own choices. And that's sort of the conceit of an RPG, is that as you level up, you're choosing skills and you're choosing gear. Just as the nature of an MMO and the internet happened, though, people quickly figured out like what the correct choices were. And then not only did they shy away from the incorrect ones, but they actually got angry about them. And they're like, don't even give me these badly itemized shaman gear. I'm not going to wear it. Why do you even put this in the game? And eventually Blizzard was like, okay, you know, we just won't make those anymore. So now all the gear is pretty viable, and you sort of can't make a wrong choice most of the time.
So
you're kind of depth and breadth. You're saying broad but not deep. You can be both broad and deep.
Yeah. They're not. Versus is in some sense the wrong thing here.
Right.
Yeah.
And then 1,000 pieces of clothing, then they all have the same.
Right. I mean, it's like you take Go, which I claim, I think Go is the deepest game humanity's ever created, is my claim. And a 60x60 Go board game board is not better than a 19x19 game, right? It's not even necessarily deep. It might be shallower because it's just so fucking random and like completely unpredictable. Okay, I've totally skipped over. Who did I skip? Who's been? I think Adam has been up.
There was somebody over there before me.
All right, so somebody over there, Go, and then Adam, and then over here.
I feel like depth, even though it can't really be measured on how the player interacts with it, ranging from luck to skill, I feel like a more true dichotomy in my experience is what the game gives back. Like, is it mostly external rewards, like in more casual games, like Bejeweled, like huge combos flying in your face, or is it more intrinsic rewards that keep you playing? And I think if you look at why you're addicted to a game, I think that goes a long way to tell whether it's deeper.
Well, let's be careful about focusing too much on like addiction as a thing, because it's hard to define. But like I would. As someone who has I have strong opinions about intrinsic versus extrinsic, but I'm not sure how Avatar skill games, which I think there are, like Sheeran is an example of a deep, or, I mean, it's a rogue, so you if you played a rogue.
I was saying, I think that skill versus luck doesn't have much.
Right. Well, that's, I guess.
You're saying that, like, when you play a roguelike, the sort of what you're getting out of it is intrinsic in that you are, like, even though it's an Avatar skill game, really, like, roguelikes are also highly player skill because you are learning more about the system, and every time you play, you're much more.
But I think that's why an Avatar skill game, a deep Avatar skill game, is different from WoW, which is clearly an Avatar skill game because there's not that much to learn, ignoring Battlegrounds. But like you know, for the because all the builds are okay now and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think rather than talking about the addiction to the game, it would be better to say what makes the game compelling. Is it I sort of see it as intrinsic versus external rewards. For like with WoW, you want to get gold, which doesn't really have to do with, or you want to get gold and you want to get good loot, which doesn't really have to do with the gameplay itself. It doesn't really have to do with the combat, which is mostly simply clicking.
Right.
Whereas in other games, other arguably deeper games,
like League of Legends or Counter-Strike, yeah. Like you would.
But let's call WoW a single player game in this sense, because you're progressing yourself. I mean, in some sense, like it's not a competitive multiplayer game in that same.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know, but the PvP.
I would say NetHack. Like those roguelikes are all about. Next time I play, I'm gonna know more, and I'll be even Spelunky too. Like you physically get better at that game, like
right.
Very much. So.
Yeah. All right.
I was gonna say there's a peculiar kind of breadth that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that Spelunky does, and my personal rabbit hole game is Street Fighter,
yep.
Which has this, at first you're just like, and it was actually kind of a turnoff for me. So at some point,
you had to study.
You get to a point where, can't really progress much farther without having an encyclopedic knowledge.
It's like opening moves in chess, where you're just like, oh, come on.
Right. Yeah. If you don't know the 65th one and what its properties are in this situation, then you're kind of out of luck.
Well, I think that's kind of why Paul and I both like the simpler games. I mean, there are books of problems in Go that you kind of need to know, but it doesn't feel as much like I got to know that the pseudo armor has the +5 or the whatever.
I mean, it's an interesting point. Like, I would have said that Street Fighter is a fairly simple, fairly deep multiplayer game, but you're right.
It is like going to a point. It's like you dig down, and then you hit this reservoir.
Right, and now you have to know like the frame interrupts of like every move, like so you know which one beats which one.
So you keep talking about simplicity and depth, like as if okay, it'd be simple and deep. But to me, like that just sounds like kind of weird because any game that I think of as being deep has to start off being simple. So like, I guess it's just like the principles of easy to learn, difficult to master. Like when you're thinking about any sport or any of the things that you brought up, specifically on multiplayer competitive. All right.
Like, wait. So why are you tying them together? Because like you can't. I mean, I can imagine.
This isn't multiplayer, but Dwarf Fortress is a good example of like complicated and deep.
Sure, that's why I'm going back to multiplayer. Yeah. What I'm trying to get to is the inherent thing, when I think of something being deep, is that I can play something for a long time and develop skills, but it still remains to be fair. And that's what I'm getting to. The system, when exposed and you put hours and hours and hours into it, and it still seems fair and the system still works in the same way that it did early on, it doesn't that make it. Like, doesn't that seem to be deep? Because it doesn't seem deep to me if I can get something at the beginning and I go more and more and more and then I realize that I've
But I don't understand why that means it needs to be simple. Like my game, I mean, to the extent that Spy Party is deep, and hopefully it is deep and will get deeper. I mean, I'm trying for like it's you have to read a 4-page manual before you can play my game, right? Like it's just a complicated game. Even though, I mean, eventually I'll tutorialize it and make it, but like it's I think that I mean it's bad form I guess to use your own game. But what's in it? I mean, Dwarf Fortress is so complication is kind of the point of it. But like I don't think that but a multiplayer you said restricting it to multiplayer. I guess I see those as separate. You want to make it easy to learn, difficult to master, right? The difficult to master part is the deep, and the easy to learn is how well you're good at, how good you are at tutorials and stuff. But that seems separate. Like you can fuck that part. Say again.
The thing like if you first Spy Party, right? You have to read manual, understand that there's a lot of deep mechanics there. But then there's an incredible amount of breadth as well because each of those things that you have to learn are separate things.
It's more just like I just haven't spent any time on the tutorial, right? So it seems to me that like there's the depth part. I guess what I'm saying is I think the phrase easy to learn, difficult to master is a great design goal, but it mixes together multiple different things, deep being one of them and accessible being another.
Go is a simple game,
yes.
But it's hard to learn and hard to master.
Well, no, it's easy to learn.
It's not
executing the mechanics of Go is trivial.
It's not that easy to learn. I have studied a deep amount of Go.
Wait.
I don't even know if a game
my
is over.
We can't judge who won. If we give up judging who won the game for just the sake of the conversation, my 8-year-old knows how to play Go. She can't actually tell who won, but she can play.
I can't tell who won.
Right, but there's two rules. Like, I mean, it's not hard mechanically.
It seems like depth transcends the game mechanics. So in Dwarf Fortress, you know how to interact with the game, you know how to play it, but if you're playing it to see what sort of stories the dwarves are telling, because when you look at a character, you see all the things they've dealt with. If that's of interest to you, if you're metagaming it, that's depth.
But that's that in some sense to me, that story aspect seems like more like the thematic, meaningful, profundity, depth, not a thing that we're calling meaningful on this slide for the sake of argument. But you've been holding your hand for a while.
Yeah. I wanted to touch on emergence.
Okay. I added that one right before we came up here, so I'm the least able to defend that one. But go on. Tear it to pieces.
So you use Conway's Game of Life as like that first example.
Yeah.
I'm not like a semantics guy, but I think it's important to talk about emergence in two fields. So there's emergence of game systems that alter just the game's state in terms of like what's going on, what's the environment that you're playing in. Conway's Game of Life has a lot of emergence in that sense. Mm-hmm. That's constantly changing what you're seeing in the play field.
Yep.
But I agree with you. The interaction, the opportunity space for the player is not very great.
Well, even ignoring that part, I just think that keep going, sorry.
So I think the counter side of emergence, I think, is whether you want to call it emergence or dynamics, right? The emergence of different behaviors based on a large possibility of the player.
Right.
So I think you could look at emergence as a way to Because I think that the emergence in some systems often will reveal a lot, will reveal enough content, or sort of create enough content just in the way the randomization does.
Yeah, I shouldn't. I shouldn't have used life because it's not a game. Like, I mean, it's just not interactive. So I didn't mean, when I was saying not deep, it's like I can see a glider gun manufacturing thing and think that's really cool and beautiful and emergent and chaotic and cool, but it doesn't feel like it's deep in the same. It's just a bad example. It's a totally distracting example because it's not interactive. What's a better example of a very emergent Spelunky? Yeah, but
I would say, like, these are things that take a long time. StarCraft probably has some emergent stuff.
Well, all games have some emergence.
Like, MVC 2 had weird emergent stuff where, you know, Marvel vs. Capcom 2 is a fighting game and has this long 10, 12 year history, and it got like Galapagos Island in Brooklyn specifically, and people went way down the rabbit hole and invented a different way to play the game. And it's the only Japanese made fighting game that Americans have been better at Japanese players at for like 6 or 8 years.
Huh.
And they perfected it and found and developed.
Well, I mean, I think Looking Glass strove for emergence, right? Like back in the rest in peace, but like, you know, Thief or System Shock or Underworld, where, you know, the orcs get together and talk about how you treated them that day at night and then like decide whether or not they're going to attack you while you're fishing the next day. And just things like that are just like this kind of systemic kind of thing. And you see if we define it, I mean, one working definition of emergence is a designer surprised by their own game, right? And I think that actually, like, one useful use of that, one reason that's hand-wavy enough is you can put user-generated content under there as well. Like, Spore was like, whoa, holy shit, this is crazy stuff. And it's not systemic emergence in that same Looking Glass way, but I do think that's separate from depth. I think you can have emergence without depth. I mean, I think they're better when they're together, but I do think they're separate.
I think for the most part,
the term emergence is used in more weight than depth. Not talking about emergence.
Yeah.
The emergence is certainly
Yeah.
I think for the most part, like, four of these things on the right, at least, it may be, like, complicated, meaningful, well, maybe not meaningful, complicated, emergent, and wide are definitely all ways that you can add depth to your game, and they don't necessarily add depth to your game, but they can go a long way.
Right. Yeah, I'm arguing that this type of emergence
does. Right. Well, wait, hold on. Okay, you're building off that immediately? Yeah. Okay, because these guys in the back are next after him. Okay.
I don't know.
Let him finish up this point. Are you on this point as well?
I was actually from a while back.
Really, I think there's varying levels of difficulty. Like, there's physical skill. Like,
as far as the arguments you guys made about Go kind of may have refuted that point, but can anyone name a game that you think that can easily be tacked on each one of those?
Do you mean one that hits all of these guys?
Of, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
NetHack, potentially.
Dwarf Fortress, to me, is complicated because the UI is so obtuse. So does an obtuse UI make a game complicated?
Wait, okay. Wait, hold on. Okay, that is a rat hole we're not going down. Executive privilege of no, we're not talking about Dwarf Fortress's UI or its renderer. Hold on. I do want to say something, though. When these things are up on here, these things are not like, if you do these things, then Chris and Paul think your game is good. These are just axes to talk about, right? So hard is a scalar axis, and the point that this versus means and the point of these is just that these things are not what we're talking about when we're talking about depth. They're great things to talk about in when we're talking around the topic of depth, but I'm not saying that you want to be deep, hard, complicated, meaningful, emergent, and wide, right? That's not what I'm saying. Just to be clear, if anyone's blogging this. All right, you back, hold on, way back there. Yeah.
So do you think it's possible that depth is somewhat the symbiotic relationship between the player and the game? Like the dialogue that the designer has with the player where it's no single input of what the player does, but the combination
that necessitates
both.
Yeah, I mean, I think,
right,
I don't think that's the only way that you can get depth, but I think that is a good way to get depth, and maybe like even a pure way.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to like a bunch of Looking Glass school game design philosophy of like abdicating authorship and improvisation and all that sort of thing, and I think that I agree with Paul, which is that like, those are you often found in depth, but they're not necessary or sufficient, I think, for depth. They're,
I think I noticed we talked a lot about how emergence, or just, if not emergence, or really wide possibility space can create depth. And I've been wondering, since you mentioned how a game like Raid, just in its mechanics, is very deep, but it is also very scripted and just progression based. And I think a game like Portal and Portal 2 are also. Are also very deep, and I'm wondering why.
Well, here, so let's, one of the things, let's have the Braid discussion then. So I claim, mechanically speaking, ignoring the meaningful slash thematic, like Braid is clearly like, trying to be, the plot, quote unquote, of Braid, the story is trying to be deep in that way, that meaningful, profound. Ignore that completely. I claim the puzzles in Braid are deep, and the puzzles in Portal are not. He claims the puzzles and neither of them are deep. And so we're going to have a little small conversation, which everyone is welcome to join. We're going to...
Yeah, I would
like
your
book. Right,
kind of a similar sort of methodology.
Right, so what I would claim is that Braid actually explored that space of the puzzle, the puzzle space that it was exploring more thoroughly, and you learned more about what you were, the systems you were dealing with when you were solving puzzles there. You came away with more of a... with more of an epiphany when you're playing Braid, whereas Portal was more like, I got this portal gun, and these are some clever puzzles, but you weren't learning about the universe in some sense to preview like Mark and John's talk, which is coming up next. You're not like I think the Braid puzzles are deep because they were structured in a way that you learn something about the world. Both the game world and the real world at the same time. Whereas Portal, those are some clever puzzles. I mean, more so in 1 than 2. I thought the puzzles in 2 were kind of weak, actually. But they were clever puzzles, but they were just clever for clever's sake. They weren't, like, teaching you something about space and, like, what is... Braid's about time manipulation. What is Portal about? I mean, it's got the Portal gun, but what is it about? What like, is it moving between space? Is it connectedness? Is it topology? Like, none of the puzzles really taught me about topology, which is a thing you could imagine learning about from Portal. Do you want to go?
I sort of disagree with the last one a little bit, which is that I do feel like, especially in Portal 1, like, I did feel like my mind being expanded a little bit as I was playing. Like, the first time I even saw the demo for Portal, you know, when it was, maybe it was the Dracula drop still then, but they showed it, and it was just like, wow, you know, like...
Oh, I love, again, I love Portal. Like, it's just not, no, the depth thing.
And we all agree that it's a great game.
Right.
No question.
I wonder if you think that there's a finite reason that in Braid you learn about the world and learn about the
I think that's part of what Mark and John's talk. I mean, I saw a rehearsal a couple of days ago, and I think that's what they're trying to get to. But for me, just focusing on the depth thing as opposed to the truth thing, which is what they're going to focus on in the next talk, but like the depth aspect of that to me comes from the fact that Braid is trying to get to some truth about time. Whereas Portal, you definitely learn things, but you learn things that were useful for solving puzzles, not things that were about causality, for example, which is one of the things you think about in Braid, and whether you're thinking about this consciously or whether you're just playing puzzles or something. But
I
mean, like,
I guess I'm missing the distinction, because if it, even though it's not causality and time manipulation, of course, in Portal, you are learning about different ways to use physics and momentum, which is something that's not really touched on.
I think in Portal is there in the first half of the game, I think you are learning these general skills that are kind of roughly applicable. I think in the second half, they kind of go down the rabbit hole into weird counterintuitive concepts.
Yeah, hunt the portalizable surface.
And I think, at least the way Braid was laid out in my play experience with it was, especially in the second half of the game, you were learning weird general principles that allowed you to suddenly solve 4 different problems. So I think there's something about this broadly applicable knowledge that you gain.
Well,
maybe
I
it speaks to depth more than these single counterintuitive, like the old swinging rope problem. It's like, how I connect these ropes,
yeah,
and people don't know how to do it until they see one swinging on
the top. I think if you look at both Braid and Portal, you can see that the way they each explore their respective sort of systems is they start out with one specific way of manipulating things. Well, Portal 2 will all look at specifically in this case, because with Braid, it's pretty much like a big chunk of the game is just about reversing time and using that to solve puzzles. And later there's...
No, but I disagree with that. I think Braid is about reversing time, what are the consequences of that, and there are puzzles built that test your understanding of those consequences, which is very different from Portal, which, again, I enjoyed Portal a lot, but I think Portal was about making puzzles with a portal gun.
Yeah, I think Right, but how is that different?
They had similar tutorial structures.
Yeah, but how is that, I guess what I'm asking is, how is that different than RAID being about solving puzzles with time?
Right. That's again. I think maybe they'll talk about that next hour. I don't know how to say it any more clearly than what I was saying. It's like it's more about. It's in some sense an intent thing. I'm not a believer in intent in art. Like I'm totally the intentional fallacy. If you're into art theory and all that kind of stuff, like I don't. But it comes out. A totally dumb way of saying it is like he was taking it more seriously.
I think just because emergence is different, but I really struggle to believe that deep emergence. Now, define emergent to be, you know, a small rule, like, okay, you made it through an hour one time using this trigger button.
Right.
And what happens is all these crazy puzzles come out. And it's like, I didn't change the rule on every single level. It's just one small rule, and all these puzzles emerge from it.
There's a lot of steps in between those, though. Yeah, I mean,
and Go and chess, there's such a big space of sport, but right. Not just, oh, I can be in a lot of places. It's like, there's all these little micro...
Yeah, I think that's for me at least, for the purpose of this slide, that's an overly broad definition of emergent because it allows it to cover. Because, like, in other words, you could define deep to mean all these things too. So I worry about that.
Well, that's like that these new places are emerging from a simple set of
right.
Makes that
cool. Okay, you get the last word.
Right. So for me, portal or RAID are not deep because you can't figure it out and there's no one else to learn. Now, to figure out the puzzle, solve it.
Right, so that's a replayability. Like it's spoilerable, is what we were talking about. Is that? But I claim when you're so here's the question. When we were talking about that, like, because you can go read how to play Braid, and then boom, the game's all done in Portal 2, right? Because there's no player skill in those games except for the mental, like, you know, solving the puzzle. But I would claim that like the process you're going through when solving. So this is the question. This is different from Portal. Portal and Braid are just good examples of puzzle games. So, but can a puzzle be deep? Because it's spoilerable. You know, a puzzle. And I think so because the process your brain's going through while you're playing the puzzle can expand your brain. Like you can think differently after it.
I mean, I think there's some space to learn, but then you hit a wall that is finishing whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's a piece of content you consumed it.
Yeah. I mean, is that mental hardness and not death?
There are hard puzzles that are hard for the hard's sake, and then there are puzzles that are deep. And so I claim that puzzles are a game design thing that can fall into all these. There's complicated puzzles. There's, you know, I guess there's meaningful puzzles. I mean, some of the Braid, like the puzzle at the end of Braid where you have to rewind the whole fucking level is not a hard puzzle. It's just trying to be a meaningful puzzle. But, like, I don't know. So I feel fairly strongly that there are deep puzzles that are different from hard puzzles.
I think it comes down to definition, I think, to some extent. And, you know, like, me coming from the strategy side, like, I sort of agree with you in terms of, like, I look at it from the interesting choices dynamic and the replayability, and you know, a puzzle game with one solution is not going to be that. We also talked about like, can a game that where you can write a walkthrough be deep? And the answer we thought was yes, actually. Like there are games, like a tower defense game that has actually, there are actually a lot of really well-crafted tower defense games that have a lot of depth, where you can write a walkthrough and I can get through the entire game with that. But that doesn't mean that the game isn't deep, or even that it's not necessarily replayable, because maybe I want to play again and explore a different path, or you know, focus on different towers. But puzzle games with one solution, I don't know. With my definition of deep, they don't satisfy.
I mean, I feel like you're using a weird example because you're talking, when you say deep, I really feel like what you're saying is that the game is not the game. I mean, if you look at Portal 2, you have all these people trying to make speed demos and trying to find different ways to solve puzzles. I mean, that in itself, to me, is deep. I mean, you've got that in the games too, and you're trying to talk about your teammates, your positioning, great feedback, your timing.
Well, I mean, there's certainly challenges that people, and too bad, sadly, we lard them with achievements these days. But there are challenges. Speedruns are the perennial example of that kind of thing. But it's not clear. I think that it's not clear that you... Like, there are speedruns on Super Meat Boy, amazing speedruns. So you watch them and you're just blown away. But again, I claim that Super Meat Boy is not that deep. So it's a great game, but by this definition, right? And Edmund agrees to there. All right. Okay, you were patient. Last word, really last word. What?
35 minutes
late. Now you ruined everything. All right, fine. Everybody raise their hand who wants to talk. All right, go.
Okay. Can I move us off of the discussion of puzzle games and back to strategy games?
Sure. Make him happy.
Cool. I'm curious what you guys think. Do you like the comparison between Go and chess, or Go and checkers, or two card games you very much like? And compare which one you think is more deep and why?
Well, Go wins all those, but...
Right. No. So,
but Go doesn't win versus Texas Hold'em. I mean, this is what Frank's talk was about online that you can go watch online. It's just a brilliant talk, and like, Like, they're deep in just completely different ways. It's not really about depth. It's more about the aesthetics of the games, like the feeling you get while playing them and things you're learning about the world. Huh? He's comparing. He compared. It's called. Life, Death, and the Middle Pair. It's comparing. It's not comparing. It's just. It's an experience. He's a good Go player and he's a good poker player. I mean, he's not great at either of them, but.
Those just seem very different to me. So I'm trying to compare chess and Go.
Right. Well, chess. I mean, you can just type chess versus Go into the internet and like go, you'll get a lot of papers on this. I mean, for me, I think Go is more beautiful because Mark LeBlanc had a great. Quote about this, which is like, when the aliens land or finally figure out how to communicate with the aliens and then we describe Go to them, they'll be like, oh yeah, we have that. Whereas that won't be the case with chess, right? Like, chess has enough rules and enough pieces and stuff that whatever their board game on a grid is going to be slightly different where the pieces move. Whereas Go is like, it's as small as you can make it, but no, it's as simple as you can make it, but no simpler, the Einstein thing. So so for me, but that's just an aesthetic thing. Like, I mean, as Frank talks about at the beginning of this talk, there's just some beauty to that board, aesthetic beauty to a Go board, with the stones and just the way it feels and everything. I other people Go doesn't like really do much for. Paul can't figure out who won. No, it's the depth, but I'm just saying Go is just this whole package to me.
I think we're talking about the elegance and the simplicity of it.
Which are separate from deep.
I agree.
Yeah.
And thus, I'm questioning this because it's way too important. I know that Go has
Yeah. The branching factor of Go is like way higher. It's 400 and something, and chess is 30 something. So, but no, I don't think so. That's complicated.
How do you separate the possibility space from the depth?
But the rules are simpler than they are in chess.
Yeah.
But the possibility space is much bigger.
Right, but the possibility space of 60 by 60 Go would be even bigger, but it wouldn't be a better game.
That's why you got the quality of the game.
You could go anywhere and go any movement.
Right, so that's right.
So it's like non-trivial navigation through possibilities.
Right, well that's why the choices are interesting, not that there's more.
There's a lot of Go on chess, so certainly it's interesting. But what checkers?
I love chess. Chess is a beautiful game. It's just not as beautiful as Go. Is checkers off? Some people were saying that checkers actually
it's close enough.
Yeah.
Checkers is much more solvable.
It's not tic-tac-toe, but it's not chess.
Right. The size of the possibility space right now.
Yeah, I don't think it's the branching factor.
Would you say that in Go there's a deeper potential for individual expression, individual style to emerge than in chess?
I don't know. I mean, the pieces don't move, so you kind of give up. Like, aggressive in Go is this really weird thing. In chess, it's like, I fucking ram my queen up your ass. Whereas in Go, it's like, I mean, it's just a very different... Like, both of those games are so abstract that the expression is very, I'm going to use logical in some weird way. Like, there's certainly, like, you can feel an aggressive Go player. I was playing my nephew, and I hadn't played chess in so long, and I was playing him, and he's 10 or something like that. And he's been playing. I mean, he's like on the chess club and everything. And so I started to lose. I'm like, fuck, I'm not going to lose to a 10-year-old. And so I just started playing like asshole 40-year-old, like, all right, kid. And I just intimidated the shit out of him and won. So that was definitely an in-game play style, right? I wasn't yelling at him or anything. I was just like, all right, this kid's going to melt if I actually, like, you know. But I mean, because he was going to kick my ass if I didn't do that. So that's a play style thing. And so both of them have that. It's just, I think that Go may be more, or I think chess might be more expressive than Go in some sense, because Go is so much more zen. I don't know. Now we're so super handwritten.
There's the famous Go fight where the guy, the other guy places one stone and the other player stands up on the table and discusses.
Well, both Frank and Clint Hawkins talk, and that's a favorite story, but there was an old versus new, like the new genre guy, the new in Japan, you know, 40 years ago or whatever. There was like the new modern like rock and roll guy, and then there was the old like guy, and they were playing a turn-based game, basically a play-by-mail game, sort of. They would make a move, and then the other person would have time to think. And so you had to, So the guy, the modern guy, the rock star guy, played a move that you just wouldn't play because it bought him two turns. The other guy had to respond, right, or he'd give up sente or whatever. But, like, it made it so that the other guy had two turns to think of his real move. It was like a no point, you know, there was no reason to fill that. The other guy had to respond, and the other guy was like, fuck you, that's just, like, not chivalrous, right? Like, you're just a dick. And he walked away. Did he walk away or lose? I can't remember.
I think he got resigned the game.
Yeah. So, anyway.
I think I would disagree with you about... I think that this doesn't exactly get at your point, but I think that I would say that magic is more deep than Go to me.
Those are bold words.
And it comes out of a couple things. Part of it is the multitude of ways you can interact with the game. Part of it is the fact that the game is always changing. So
that's not complexity?
No, I think it. You get. I mean, it adds complexity for sure. It adds breadth for sure. But I think you're getting depth with that.
Right.
And I mean, for me personally, obviously, like, I find Magic a much more compelling game to Go. And but that's not the same as Deep either.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah,
it's like a dungeon master relationship. Like Wizards is almost just saying, like, oh, it's 2012. Here's some new ingredients in the mix.
I mean, there's an RL.
You. Like, where would that sit on the spectrum?
Yeah, I mean Magic versus Go, clearly you would agree ROI rules to output of complex of depth, right? Yeah. I mean, in other words, you're playing a lot more. If I don't agree, but if I'm not as good as Magic players, you are. So like
right.
if it is more deep, you're certainly paying way more than the amount it's deeper in rules, I would assume, right? The complexity and the breadth. Would you agree with that at least? Go is more parsimonious, like in,
Sure. I mean, Go has fewer rules than almost any game out there. Right? Yeah. And tic-tac-toe. I mean, I don't agree that it has two rules; it has more like that.
Yeah. All right, fine. All right, Steve.
Okay, so I just wanted to kind of wrap up and go back to a pragmatic question.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if we can think of some games that have the potential to be really deep, but that depth is never explored. I feel like those outlying edge cases.
So the most personal.
Chris trying to build a spy party.
So Spore speaks very highly to my design. I'm making Spy Party the way I am because Spore was made the way it was. Pardo's talk where I learned about the depth. So Rob Pardo is the chief game designer at Blizzard, and he gave a talk at GDC Austin in the middle of Spore's development where he talked about this depth versus complexity thing, or depth versus accessibility later thing, and it was written up on Gamasutra, and I read it. And I'm just like, oh my God, we're doing everything wrong according to this, right? Like, this is how you make a really good game, and we're just doing this completely backwards. Except, so we did accessibility first, depth later, which is depth never, basically,
right.
Due to the realities of shipping a modern game. Except, I realized, in the editors we made really shitty but really powerful, and then we figured out how to make them accessible. And it's the one part of the game that's magical, right, is making the creatures and they come to life and all that stuff.
Right.
And so,
what we're expecting was,
to do something, right, exactly. So what we called it, and during development, we called it editor consequence,
right.
And there just was none, basically.
Right.
I mean, and so for me, the biggest, and this may just be a personal thing because I spent 6 years on it or whatever, for me, the biggest missed opportunity for depth was Spore, where we had a provably awesome, deep content creation tools, and then it did nothing with them in the game. So that's my example. I don't know.
I guess I'm thinking of things like there are 100 first-person shooters that have the exact same.
Yeah.
What is the difference?
It's so hard to put it's just perfect.
Have you ever played Sacrifice?
Uh-uh. Yeah.
Oh, man. Take that out of the bin.
Yeah.
It's fucking awesome. It was designed by the StarCraft team. And it's like a 3D RTS with like a gesture system way before black and white. And it's crazy. It has unbelievable depth. And I know that because I've worked with those guys on a game. And they like would play it. And I tried to play with them. And I would just get destroyed.
Right.
And then I really put a lot of time to try to learn how to play it, and it was super deep, but no one ever fucking played it.
Right.
And I think there's some really important thing there that's like depth, but also like depth that draws you in enough.
Oh, you have to, like, it's not depth first, accessibility never either. Like,
but it wasn't accessibility.
I guess what I'm saying, this is where the difficult to master, easy to learn thing comes in,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is like, there's. Deep is not what you need to do to make a great game that sells a lot of copies.
Right.
Like, it's just one thing you might want to explore. You've got to do all that other shit. You have to market your game, too. Like, I mean, you've got to worry about all this stuff, which we're not talking about today. So.
It's sufficiently deep. Just playing it a lot doesn't always happen. Like, I've embarrassingly not logged somewhere in the neighborhood of, like, 200 Street Fighter hours in the last year or two. And I am nowhere near, like, I'm like, would do a fair showing at the first fight of the tournament, but would
Yeah, talent comes into play. Talent, I mean, that's what I mean. I'm worried about. I'm doing the server side stuff for the Spy Party beta, and like, you know, the first thing I'm going to do because of I don't want to have to deal with the ranking system stuff. I've got this. I found this cool paper on ranking, and I'm going to do that. But initially, I'm just going to display number of games played because time on task at the beginning is a fine thing. But eventually, talent comes into play. Like, and that's just, and your game has to be deep enough to accept talent, and that's why the professional basketball players get millions of dollars, because they actually, I mean, there are tons of stories of, like, you know, kind of the low guy who never comes off the bench, professional basketball player, who goes, you know, and, like, I just heard one the other day from a friend. He, one of those guys, who just basically never gets off the bench, came and played one of the local games, and, like, he was, like, made out of magic. Like, I mean, he's the shittiest guy in the basketball team, but, like, no human can touch him, because he's just, like, you know, so it's just the level of skill in a game like that, talent comes
to. There's also a difference between like seeing and appreciating the depth and being able to compete at the highest level. You know, like there, you know, same thing with Magic or any of those games.
Yeah, yeah.
You just can't.
I mean, I got good enough at Go to look over the precipice, and I was like, wow. Right. And that's,
as long as you can,
that's,
yeah. You can see it.
But I, yeah. All right. We're done. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all.